Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, April 9th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartas. In the news tonight, Idaho's Legislative Advisory Council, co-led by Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, yanks funds for Latah County Historical Society project, citing legislative intent. Other humanities activities in Idaho frozen because of the DOGE cuts at the National Endowment for Humanities. Idaho's new local preemption laws impacting health and pedestrian safety could have lethal impacts. Trump administration removes WSU student visa days after the administration removed the student visas of two University of Idaho students. We'll hear from University of Idaho law school professor and head of the Immigration Litigation and Appellate Clinic at the UI Law School, Jeffrey Heeren, who gave a talk to the Moscow League of Women Voters today on the embattled state of immigrant rights. And the Pullman City Council confirms Andy Brashears as the new police chief. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Reports.
The World Meteorological Organization.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartas, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Elon Musk's dismantling of much of the U.S. government has resulted in severe cuts to the National Endowment for the Humanities, which has resulted in turn in the defunding of all 50 states' humanities councils last week. That means the Idaho Humanities Council has lost 75% of its funding, causing Moscow's Kenworthy Performing Arts Center to stop work on a restoration of the first feature film ever made in Idaho, 1919's silent film Told in the Hills, which Kenworthy director Colin Mannix says is a Western romance that involved up to 200 Nez Perce actors and defies expectations about representation of Native Americans in early cinema. The Idaho Humanities Council had approved $7,500 for the restoration project, which would have come from federal funds. Separately, the Idaho Advisory Council has yanked the $19,000 grant it previously approved to the Latah County Historical Society for an exhibit on dry land agriculture that would travel throughout the state. The money was to come from the America 250 in Idaho grant program. In a letter from District 6 Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, who is on the Idaho Advisory Council, Mitchell said the grant was canceled after careful consideration of legislative intent. The wording about legislative intent in some ways mirrors the reasoning the Trump-Musk administration's National Endowment for the Humanities gave when they withdrew already approved grants to the Idaho Humanities Council and the Humanities Councils in all 50 states last week. The letter from the National Endowment of the Humanities said, NEH has reasonable cause to terminate your grant in light of the fact NEH is repurposing its funding allocations in a new direction in furtherance of the president's agenda. Representative Mitchell and Republican Senator Ben Adams of Nampa are the co-chairs of the Idaho Advisory Council overseeing the America 250 celebrations in Idaho for the 250th anniversary of the U.S. set for 2026. They sent letters to nonprofits this week to around the state planning commemoration, saying they had rescinded their previously approved grants. One of the recipients was the Twin Falls Historic Preservation Commission, which had planned to tell the underrepresented story of Chinese immigrants in southern Idaho and their impact on the state's mining history. The grant would have helped complete the last phase of an ambitious multi-phase archaeological survey of Chinese gold mining sites in the Snake River Canyon near Twin Falls and help finalize the establishment of a National Register Snake River Canyon Historic Mining District. The Idaho State Historical Society had allocated money for that and 30 other 250th anniversary projects statewide late last year. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, 29 out of the 31 grants have been canceled by the Advisory Council. The letter to the Twin Falls Historic Preservation Commission said, after reviewing the Idaho State Historical Society's America 250 in Idaho grant program, we met with Director Gallimore to discuss how these grants comport with the Advisory Council's vision for America 250 in Idaho. After careful consideration of legislative intent, the grant program through America 250 is canceled. We appreciate your organization's role in preserving and sharing Idaho's history, providing information and understanding that educates and inspires. We trust that Director Gallimore will continue to find ways to support the outstanding work you do. Twin Falls Commission member Ronald James said, "It feels like you just have the rug pulled out from under you. In a way, it's like a betrayal because, first off, we were encouraged to seek these grants and to pursue this. This project I've been working on for the last 7 or 8 years, and then right when you're right in the middle of doing what you're supposed to do and you're having success within your craft, they turn around and say, they just don't know. They say, sorry, we don't want this anymore." The Trump administration has revoked the visas of several international students from 3 of the Inland Northwest's 4 major universities. WSU spokesperson David Wasson reported yesterday a student who completed their undergraduate degree left the country in December but legally required a work permit in order to return to the United States. That has been revoked. Gonzaga University officials in Spokane said Monday the Trump administration had revoked 2 of the student visas held by foreign students there. The University of Idaho reported the Trump administration revoked student visas of 2 of their students last week. These students joined dozens from the University of Washington and hundreds nationwide who the Trump administration has targeted for visa revocations in the last few weeks. There's no word on why the Trump administration revoked the visas of most of the students living in the Northwest. While the Trump administration has at times emphasized they want to deport foreign students that commit illegal acts, they have also said they want to deport people who do nothing illegal but have exercised their free speech rights by participating in protests against Israel's genocide in Gaza. The New York Times reported on April 1st, Trump Secretary of State Marco Rubio ordered diplomats to scour student visa applications and investigate foreign students' social media because Rubio was looking for, quote, somebody who is suspected of having terrorist ties or sympathies who had a student or exchange visa between October 7th, 2023 and August 31st, 2024, or who had a visa terminated since that October date. On March 28th, Rubio revoked the visas of 300 people, and after his immigration squads detained a 30-year-old Tufts University doctoral student from Turkey, Rumeysa Ozturk, for asking the school to acknowledge the Palestinian genocide, Rubio said Ozturk's activities, quote, run counter to the foreign policy of the United States. He later said, "I just think it's crazy to continue to provide visas so people can come here and advocate for policies that are in direct contradiction of our national interest." President Donald Trump issued an executive order earlier saying he will revoke all student visas belonging to people who protest against Israel on the false presumption that the protests are anti-Semitic. Trump's order said, "To all the resident aliens who joined in the pro-jihadist protests, we put you on notice. Come 2025, we will find you and we will deport you. I will also quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radical like never before." There's no evidence that college campuses are infested with radicalism like never before, although most campuses do have contingents that advocate for human rights. Three of the bills Governor Brad Little signed yesterday are examples of local preemption laws that may have lethal consequences. Increasingly in recent years, the far-right legislature has removed the rights of local governments to make ordinances that respond to local needs. One such law, the local sales tax law, has been in effect for decades, but most are recent. Under Senate Bill 1140, which Governor Little signed yesterday, improvements to existing or new bicycle and pedestrian facilities may only be included in a project that functions as a primary benefit to motor vehicles when the improvements serve as a collateral or secondary benefit, or when they are implemented to align with federal law. The bill has exceptions for projects near schools, parks, or other designated pedestrian or bicycle areas. The sponsor of that bill was Republican Senator Mark Harris of Soda Springs. Senate Bill 1140 says any elected official, officer, or person found to have violated or aided in the violation of the bill will be guilty of a misdemeanor and subject to a fine of no more than $1,000 upon conviction. Under Senate Bill 1144, also from Harris, highway districts would be prohibited from narrowing arterials and non-residential collectors. During House debate on Senate Bill 1140, Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise argued against, saying it would have a chilling effect because highway commissioners and other local government officials would fear voting for a project that might appear to violate the provisions of the law, but actually does not.
Any elected official, officer, or person who shall violate or aid in the violation any of the provisions of this title shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. Now think of that. Think of yourself as a county commissioner, well, as a highway district commissioner, and you're making a decision that really could go either way, and you make the wrong one. And then somebody, and you know they're out there, oh, you committed a misdemeanor, I'm going down to see the prosecutor because you have made a decision to spend money in a particular way, and that is a crime. Not a civil penalty, but it's a crime. And very importantly, in this section, 40-207 at the end, it applies to any action in Title 40. Well, Title 40 is huge. It's got provision after provision here. It's got a total of 24 chapters. Deals with taxes. Deals with highway decisions. Deals with offices. It's not just about embezzlement or taking the money and using it for your own purposes or improperly. It is very, very broad. And what can happen is you've got people out there that get mad at the highway district, just like they get mad at us, and all of a sudden, oh my gosh, you know, this commissioner is terrible in demand, and they write on social media, and they go and they get this section, and they say, misdemeanor, misdemeanor, misdemeanor. That is a huge concern. I don't know that you'll get charged with a misdemeanor, but you're going to be real careful and real cautious, and you make a lot, and it could have a lot of unintended consequences, because you'll say, well, I want to do this for this developer, but I'm kind of nervous about doing that because of this misdemeanor thing. So I don't think it's just going to work one way, a way that maybe an author of legislation would like. It might work the other way, too.
That was Representative John Gannon of Boise speaking on the House floor March 27th against one of the bills that are part of a series of potentially lethal local preemption bills the legislature has passed recently. Also on Tuesday, Governor Little signed the so-called Medical Freedom Bill, which would further restrict the right of business owners and employees to have a safe workplace by prohibiting any government entity or business from requiring a medical intervention, such as a vaccine, as a condition of employment or entry to a venue. the original bill denying businesses freedom to have safe workplaces was from Republican Senator Dan Foreman of Moscow. It was an extension of the bill Governor Little signed in 2023 prohibiting COVID vaccine requirements as a condition of employment or entry to a venue, something that allowed the 20,000-person Treefort Music Fest to move forward in Boise in September 2021 with no discernible uptick in COVID cases in the Boise area during the peak of the pandemic. The music festival, with its vaccine rule, revived the music scene after a long pandemic break at a time when Treasure Valley hospitals were on crisis standard of care because of COVID. Although the 2023 vaccine requirement prohibition has an exception for healthcare facilities, it has no such exception for other workplaces where people work closely together, such as meatpacking plants. Along the same lines, the Idaho legislature this year passed a law that prohibits local government, schools, and health districts from saving lives during a pandemic by having mask mandates. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. Available online at loveskombucha.com.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
University of Idaho Law Professor Jeffrey Heeren, who is the Immigration Litigation and Appellate Clinic Director at the law school, gave a talk today on the embattled state of immigrant rights. During the question and answer part of the talk, Heeren said, "Little is known about the case of the Trump administration revoking the student visas of two foreign University of Idaho students, which the university reported last week."
Very little is known about, has been publicly disclosed about those two cases, but there was a spokesman article reporting on it. And I believe that article did suggest that at least one of the two cases was based on protected speech and was based on the provision that I mentioned earlier involving foreign policy, the foreign policy provision. Around the country, this has been happening at universities around the country, and individuals who have their visas revoked and have their CVA status terminated because of their protected First Amendment activities have a right to file federal litigation to challenge that. In some cases, it's necessary to act very quickly because people can be put in detention. So to the extent that students are connected to that individual, that would be a good message to get out, that it's important to see a lawyer, to talk to a lawyer, to see what your options might be. There are also cases where people have had their visas revoked based on criminal conduct, although oftentimes very minor criminal infractions that never would have been an issue in the past, sometimes even traffic issues. Those are probably tougher cases because they don't involve kind of the core First Amendment issues. I see those cases involving First Amendment claims to be very strong claims based on my understanding of constitutional law. So I think getting that message out to students, and to the extent that that student wants to take a stand, I think supporting that student, I think we all have, as has been pointed out today, free speech rights. And for everyone to stand up and say that this is not okay for people to be targeted based on their, even if you disagree with somebody's protest that they held, I think most Americans agree that that person has a right to protest, right? So I think potentially people have to just be speaking out about these issues.
That was University of Idaho Law School Immigration Litigation and Appellate Clinic Director Jeffrey Heeren. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the Trump administration can use the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which has never been used in peacetime before, to deport people who Trump claims are Venezuelan gang members. conducting irregular warfare on U.S. territory, but also said the administration must give them a measure of due process before deporting them, including an opportunity to appeal their cases. During his talk, Heeren said Trump is using a state of emergency declaration to justify his continuing removal of foreign nationals without due process.
On the first day back in office, President Trump declared a national emergency at the southern border, and he deployed armed forces to the border to resume construction of the border wall and to participate in border security efforts. He also designated drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. And so this raises the question, is there in fact an invasion of the United States by undocumented immigrants? Now, I was not able to find recent statistics. These statistics lately have been somewhat hard to come by. But the number of undocumented immigrants in the United States has historically been fairly static since about the middle of the last decade, at about 11 million persons. It's gone up and gone down a little bit, but for the most part, it's been fairly static. And my guess is that it's probably about 11 million people right now, and that the number has not really gone up or down too much in the last years. Now, these 11 million individuals are heavily incorporated into the United States economy. They work at a disproportionately high rate relative to the rest of the U.S. population, and they're doing many jobs that are extremely important, especially agricultural work and construction. And in Idaho, in particular, undocumented immigrants are heavily involved in our state's dairy industry, which, if you listen to the Dairymen's Association, the work would be very difficult to do without reliance on that labor source and without the support of those people who are doing those jobs right now. And that's an industry that's extremely vital to our state's economy. Now, I think that there's this conception that everyone who's undocumented in this country illegally crossed the border, but in fact, there are two ways to be undocumented in the United States. One is if somebody entered without inspection. The other is if somebody overstayed a visa. And again, recent statistics are very hard to come by, but at least as of 2014, the number of people who overstayed their visa was much higher than the number of people who entered without inspection, which also, I think, undermines the president's claim that there's an invasion at the southern border. And my sense is that although the numbers may look somewhat different today, there's still, I'm sure, a very high percentage of the undocumented population consists of people who entered lawfully into the United States but then overstayed their visa for a variety of reasons that people do.
UI Law School Immigration Litigation and Appellate Clinic Director Jeffrey Heeren. Professor Heeren said the Trump administration recently made changes in how the deportation process works.
Typically, in deportation cases, the first step is that after somebody is apprehended by an ICE officer, the officer makes a determination whether the person should be served with a notice to appear for immigration court or whether they can be put in an expedited process called expedited removal. And persons who are in expedited removal don't ever get to go in front of a judge. They're deported based on paperwork issued by an officer. This is something that's existed in U.S. law since 1996. The one sort of escape valve from expedited removal is if somebody expresses a credible fear of persecution in their country of origin, then they... If the officer finds that they have a credible fear, their case goes back to the immigration court side of this infographic, and they go to a removal hearing in front of an immigration judge. In front of an immigration judge, somebody could contest the charges against them and argue that the case should be terminated. For example, if they were arrested in violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, they could assert that as a defense to deportation, or they could request some type of affirmative relief, like asylum. The judge could terminate proceedings, the judge could grant asylum, and in those cases, the removal proceeding ends. And if the person was granted relief, they can go and obtain that status and potentially a green card and eventually citizenship. Alternatively, if they lose their case, they have a right to appeal to an administrative appeals board called the Board of Immigration Appeals, and then to the Circuit Court of Appeals. I mentioned that my students had argued in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, so that would be an example of the Circuit Court. In theory, they could go to the U.S. Supreme Court, too, but the U.S. Supreme Court takes very few cases and very few immigration court cases. So that's kind of the typical process. If somebody's in detention, I should say also that they can seek bond. So these are kind of the rights that somebody has within the removal process. I want to say that at the Board of Immigration Appeals, the Trump administration has now fired all of the board members who were appointed during the Biden administration, reducing the number of board judges from 28 to 15 members, despite the fact that there's an enormous backlog of cases at the board. So one would think that it would be an all-hands-on-deck situation where you would need as many board members as possible. Now, there have been a number of changes, as I mentioned. One is that initially the administration began using Guantanamo to house immigrant detainees. But the reality was that the detention center didn't offer the administration very many real advantages because persons who were there unquestionably were still entitled to all the rights that somebody would have within a removal proceeding. So there was very little advantage to the administration in terms of expediting cases, and there were a lot of logistical challenges. As far as I can tell, that program has been ended, and there are currently no immigration detainees at Guantanamo, leaving aside, again, the residual population of war on terror persons who are at Guantanamo, which is a separate population. A more serious change is that the Trump administration has expedited, increased its use of expedited removal. So until recently, expedited removal was applied within 100 miles of the U.S. border to persons who could not prove to an officer that they'd been in the United States for 2 years or more. The administration has now expanded it to the entire United States, to anyone who cannot prove that they've been in the U.S. for 2 years or more. Part of the reason why historically there was a more limited scope for expedited removal was that there are some serious due process questions about requiring somebody to affirmatively prove that they've been here for some period of time. And to do that to an officer who's not a judge, is not a neutral arbiter of the case, and without any possibility of appeal, and without even any timeline or real process for submitting that information or any real checks on it. So there's some real due process questions, and the ACLU has sued in January to try to stop the expansion of expedited removal. But as far as I know, I believe it is in effect at the moment throughout the United States. Another change is that the administration has repealed the sensitive locations memo that had previously prevented the government from enforcing immigration law at churches, hospitals, and schools. So now the administration has stated that it will henceforth be enforcing immigration law in all of those places. And a number of religious denominations, various Quaker groups, Unitarian churches, Jewish congregations, a large number of different religious denominations have filed lawsuits arguing that this violates their First Amendment freedom of religion to go into churches during worship services while people are praying and deport them from the United States. Another change is that DHS has dusted off the modern version of the 1940 alien registration law that I mentioned that had been the basis for the prosecution of Harry Bridges, I'm sorry. And it is now requiring, in modern times, the alien registration provision has not been widely enforced, but the Trump administration has stated that all undocumented persons in the United States have to come forward and register, and if they fail to do so, they can not only be deported, but also prosecuted for failing to register. Probably one of the biggest changes is that in March of 2025, President Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 for the first time since World War II, claiming that the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua constituted an invasion of the United States. The Alien Act was part of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were heavily criticized at the time by no less than Thomas Jefferson, and I believe James Madison, and since then have been widely criticized by historians and legal figures. Justice Hugo Black stated that they had been, quote, repudiated by history. And yet the Trump administration has invoked it to justify the deportation of members of the Tren de Aragua gang, or alleged members, I should say, because the Trump administration has not created any process for their membership in that gang to be adjudicated. And in fact, over 130 Venezuelan nationals were deported to El Salvador, where they are detained in the Terrorism Confinement Center, which is a very scary prison in El Salvador. And these deportations occurred despite a federal judge's order temporarily enjoining deportations while he considered the legality of the use of the Alien Enemies Act. During a hearing on April 3rd of 2025, Judge Boasberg, the judge in that case, indicated that the administration may have acted in bad faith by deporting persons while his TRO was in effect. The Justice Department has defended its actions, arguing that the court's order did not apply to flights already in transit, and asserting that the judge overstepped his authority. The Supreme Court, just this week, has now vacated Judge Boasberg's TROs, holding that the challengers should have brought. It's a very procedural decision. It's not a decision that nobody has a right to challenge the invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. Instead, the decision is that those challenges need to be brought as habeas petitions in the district in Texas where they were initially detained, or wherever they're initially detained. So that's the reason why the Supreme Court has vacated Judge Boasberg's TROs. If you're wondering who some of the gang members who have been deported to El Salvador, to this prison in El Salvador, are, one example is Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. He was not deported, I don't believe, pursuant to the Alien Enemies Act, but he was deported to this prison in El Salvador, which you see depicted here in a video that, as I understand it, the government of El Salvador itself released, and his wife, who you see depicted here, identified him in that video. He has a wife and a U.S. citizen son. And the thing that's most remarkable about his deportation is that he was granted a benefit called withholding of removal in 2019, where a judge held that he could not be deported to El Salvador, the exact place that the Trump administration deported him to. And DOJ Department of Justice attorney Erez Rivini admitted in court proceedings that his deportation was an administrative error. Soon afterward, the Trump administration put him, as well as his supervisor, on indefinite paid leave. The judge in that case, District Court Judge Paula Zinnes, has ordered Abrego's return, but the Trump administration has appealed. The Fourth Circuit denied the Trump administration's request for a stay of Judge Zinnes' order that he be returned. And the full stay decision is at the Supreme Court right now. The Supreme Court has issued an administrative stay, which means that they're not requiring that he'd be brought back right now, but they're taking briefing and they'll be deciding this case in the time going forward. Now, the Trump administration's position is that it does not have the authority to order the president of El Salvador to do anything. Abrego's position is that the court has the power to order the government to at least try to return him. And in fact, there are probably many diplomatic measures that the U.S. government could take to try to get somebody back from El Salvador and to work with the Salvadoran government. As law professor Stephen Vladek put it, a world in which federal courts lack the power to order the government to take every possible step to bring back to the United States individuals like Abrego Garcia is a world in which the government could send any of us to a Salvadoran prison without due process. Claim that the misstep was the result of administrative error and thereby wash its hands of any responsibility for what happens next. And that's, I think, a world that none of us want to live in.
That was University of Idaho Law School Immigration Litigation and Appellate Clinic Director Jeffrey Heeren speaking to a meeting of the Moscow League of Women Voters this afternoon.
Oregon ranked 9th this year on the State Energy Efficiency Scorecard. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, a nonprofit research organization, ranks states based on their latest policy developments and efforts to save energy. This year's scorecard highlights Oregon's performance standard for large commercial buildings and efforts to upgrade existing buildings. Jennifer Kalez from the Oregon Department of Energy says even though the state's energy demands continue to increase with the population, Oregon's per capita energy consumption is down.
So while we may have more people in our state, We're using less energy per person thanks to efficiency and conservation efforts.
Oregon also scored points for zero emission vehicle policies, including EV rebates and emission standards. Energy Trust of Oregon, a nonprofit that helps people save energy by making their homes more efficient, was recognized in the scorecard for promoting equity. Energy Trust's Julianne Thatcher says they are designing programs that meet the needs of utility households in rural areas, those with low and moderate incomes, communities of color, and small businesses.
For the state to save more energy going forward and meet its climate goals, we need everyone to be able to directly participate in our programs and benefit from lower energy bills.
The Trump administration has paused key Biden-era funding, including the Inflation Reduction Act, which supports investments in energy efficiency, clean energy, and electric vehicle manufacturing. Kayla says for now, Oregon's federal funding is still available, and the DOE's energy efficiency programs will continue despite the uncertainty. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Weather partly cloudy tonight and tomorrow, low 41, high 70. Thursday night, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, low 44, west winds 10 to 15. 20% chance of showers Friday, snow level 5,000 feet, lowering to 4,300 feet, mostly cloudy, high 54. Partly cloudy Friday night, low 36. And on Saturday, 40% chance of precipitation, a chance of snow showers before 2 p.m., then a chance of rain showers. Snow level rising to 3,000 feet in the afternoon. Partly sunny, high 46, and breezy. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Currently 54 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are available, $25, $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Also, you can buy tickets to the KRFP Real Radio Dinner, which is for Friday the 18th of April at 6 o'clock, starting with a mixer at the 1912 Center. They're available online at krfp.org and ticket outlets. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and David Katz assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Flashpoints is up next. Lockdown Mosh Pit on at 7:30, and at 8:30, music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead through the decades. We'll have Sounds of the Future, a locally produced show at 10 o'clock tonight. Music, entertainment, information throughout your evening. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Palouse Prairie Charter School, an EL Education accredited expeditionary learning model school serving students in northern Idaho. PPCS is a free public charter school that combines hands-on learning, rigorous academics, outdoor adventure, and character development. PalouseprairieSchool.org. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Contemporary, which connects, supports, and creates community through art and arts education. Moscow Contemporary is located at 2012 West Pullman Road and moscowcontemporary.org.